I'm going to call to order this February 11th, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development. Welcome, everyone. Today's topic is another piece of that jigsaw puzzle that we call higher education and workforce development. And it has to do with the Office of Degree Authorization and other entities that work with and oversee private career colleges and degree-granting private universities. We're going to actually, we have a series of bills that we need to entertain that all of which we heard back in 2011, but for various reasons they didn't move forward then. But there is still a need to address these bills and the issues in them, and so we will be having public hearings on these various bills. But before we do that, just, you know, we need to understand the lay of the land with respect to how private career colleges work and for-profit entities in the state. And so to start off, we have an information session which has to do with the work of the Office of Degree Authorization and the unit within the Department of Education that deal with this, and we'll also hear from representatives of the Northwest Career College Federation, again, just to set the context for all that. So I'm going to open in the information hearing on private career colleges and universities, and I'm going to call up, first of all, Jennifer Diallo, who is the director of the Office of Degree Authorization.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough and committee members, for the opportunity to present about the Office of Degree Authorization and our work. I have a presentation that I had hoped to show you, but you have the notes in front of you. Apparently, we had to send it to this computer in order to show it, so you can follow along on the paper, and I'll just follow along on my screen if that's okay. The Office of Degree Authorization has three principal functions, as you can see: degree validation, degree authorization, and adverse impact mediation. Our primary function is degree authorization, and we're responsible for authorizing private, both for-profit and non-profit colleges, as well as for establishing the exempt status of religious institutions that wish to be exempt under ORS 348.604. So for the purposes of authorization, we do a full evaluation of the school. We look at 20 standards that relate to, you know, school operations, as well as the programs, the curriculum content, and operations, support of students, and faculty and staff qualifications. Under degree validation, we basically are ensuring that people who claim a college degree in Oregon are in possession of a valid college degree. In Oregon, the definition of a valid college degree is that the college is from a regionally accredited or ODA authorized institution. So people coming in from outside the state, often if the school is not regionally accredited, then they come to us and they ask us if we would validate their degree. You know, we can establish equivalency. There are evaluation services that are recognized by ODA. Those are accredited evaluation services that are members of either NACIS, the Accreditation Service for Evaluation, International Evaluation Credentials, and National Evaluation Credentials, Degree Credentials. And then we also have ACRO, the Association of College Registrars and Admissions Officers, that is one of the recognized evaluators of college degrees internationally. And so essentially our role is just to verify these things on behalf of employers, on behalf of universities when asked, especially in the case of international degrees, often we're asked to, you know, either advise on an appropriate evaluation service or to consider, you know, special circumstances or situations related to licensure, related to standards for a particular degree. We receive requests from licensing boards sometimes about establishing the criteria for an appropriate academic curriculum for a degree, and so, you know, we assist them in sort of defining those criteria in terms of acceptable degree academic credentials for a particular type of degree. We investigate also in a sense of not, you know, law enforcement type of investigations, but just, you know, doing the research to establish whether a college is valid, especially in the international context, sometimes other states where a college is not regionally accredited or, you know, has the appropriate licensure-related accreditation, and we work with the state officials in those colleges to find out, you know, the sort of status of this school, whether it has state authorization in the state of origin, and sort of what the performance record of that college is, so that we can advise students and employers and other interested parties about the quality or the status of this college based on documented evidence. We work closely with the DOJ at times on situations where there's a school that's sort of operating outside of those lines. We often are contacted by licensing boards when they have a situation where a person is providing unlicensed practice, particularly with respect to, for example, psychology, sex offender therapy, some of the different types of licenses that require a specific sort of behavioral science or sociology. You know, a lot of times people are sort of operating between those sort of fields, and it's not really clear whether their degree relates directly to the licensure-related field based on, you know, how the university they took their degree at categorized those things or organized them. To give an example, we had a situation last year where someone had taken a degree, a master's degree in recreation studies, and in some colleges, recreational therapy is something that would be related to, for example, a community rehabilitation type of function for sex offenders, for, you know, different types of community issues and disorders, and in other schools, the recreation department is under the travel and leisure studies. So, you know, we help the licensing board discern whether this degree earned at this college really qualifies for this type of license, and when it doesn't, then we issue a cease and desist order to that person that they cannot engage in this practice, they're not licensed to do it, their degree is not related to the field, and, you know, in the cases where the degree does relate, you know, we do that by checking the Carnegie classifications and the, you know, and determining that this degree and the coursework is equivalent to a degree that would in Oregon qualify for that licensure, and then we advise the licensing board that the student's degree based on review of the transcripts and this kind of thing does qualify them.
Thanks, Jen. Jen, let me interrupt you for a sec. Rep. Huffman, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
First, on the, let's just say psychology, since you're kind of along that line. Mm-hmm. If a college from somewhere else in the U.S. has a psychology program, and Oregon students have largely taken online courses, mm-hmm. and it's not recognized, what would an appeal process be then? Does the institution, on behalf of their students, come and plead their case? How would that work?
Thank you for the question, Representative Huffman. That's an interesting issue, and we've actually had some of those things come up with, specifically with psychology in the past few years. Traditionally, online education, as long as the school was regionally accredited, that's been our standard for the degree being valid, and traditionally it was as well for the psychology licensing board. However, in the past couple of years, they've changed some of their rules, and so and it has to do specifically in that field with the type of not clinical experience, but the practical experience that the students do. And so they have something called an academic year in residence that's sort of a professional development year. And so they require sort of an ongoing sort of consistent professional development types of activities with seminars and with sort of checking in with faculty over the course of a year. And there were some online programs that were doing this more in sort of a seminar format where they were having these sort of two-week sessions throughout the year in different locations, so there wasn't the kind of consistent. And so the Psychology Licensing Board changed their rules to require this academic year in residence and, you know, made some stipulations around online education. Unfortunately, what happened was that there were students enrolled in PhD programs in psychology that then were unable to be licensed after they finished that degree. So, you know, there was sort of we worked with the Psychology Licensing Board to understand how that safety net could be, you know, put in place so that students weren't in that situation. It's a very difficult situation because of the change in the rules sort of in the midst of a program. In Oregon...
Yeah, that'll be... Okay. And I know there's a bill out there this session related to that, too. Second question, if you could give me an example... I think I followed your introduction, pardon me, but if you could, and I'm going to use a specific example just so I can kind of get my head around. Let's say ITT, they're a recognized school, so that part of it's out of the way. They want to develop a two-year RN nursing program. Mm-hmm. What steps would they go through then to qualify?
Thank you for the question. That, again, is a question that involves both us and the licensing board. So I think maybe what I should say, both with respect to the first question and this one, is we work really closely with the licensing boards because, in a sense, there's a sort of collaborative process for approval of programs that involve licensing, and we work closely with the nursing board and with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to sort of make sure that the content of the program meets the licensing standard, and then we sort of defer to the licensing board where there are these content considerations, you know, because the students are going to need to meet those standards as well as in order to be able to practice in the state. So this is, and with respect to online education, this is probably the biggest challenge because we have a lot of schools that would otherwise meet our authorization standards due to their regional accreditation, which allows sort of the limited review of the program. In other words, we sort of defer to the regional accreditor, if you will, to say that, you know, this school, because our standards are similar to regional accreditation standards, we're, you know, relying on the regional accreditation in a sense to say the school is qualified to operate in Oregon based on the validity of the degrees. At this time, because regional accreditation allows for limited review, and because we have over 600 colleges from out of state that have requested authorization, and you know it's quite it would be quite difficult, given the logistic issues alone, to do a full review of those schools, and presumably the regional accreditation establishes the quality, we're able to approve them. However, the licensing boards don't necessarily use only regional accreditation, and what we've noticed in the past few years is that where we have regionally accredited schools outside the state that don't pay attention to the Oregon standards for licensing, the students then have to be licensed in another state and go through the reciprocity process for licensing, which sometimes involves taking additional courses, sometimes involves taking another degree. In the case specifically of a school like ITT, if they want to start a nursing program, they first have to be approved by the nursing board. So we would wait for the approval of the nursing board of that the content of that program, and then we would approve it as a degree program. We normally would not approve the program before licensure or before accreditation if an accreditation is required for licensure. The problem is that sometimes you have this chicken and egg situation where the program has to be approved by us before the accreditor will approve it. We want the nursing board to approve it before we'll approve it, and so we're all sort of working together to make sure we're all on board at the time this is approved.
Jennifer, if I could just jump in. So And we could really get into the weeds on this, mm-hmm. and spend five hearings, you know,
yes.
on this. And we only have a couple more minutes. But to put it up at the 30,000-foot level again, mm-hmm. There are two major kinds of accreditation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've been referring to regional accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
And regional accreditation, for example, we're part our Oregon universities and community colleges and many of the independent colleges are part of what's called the Northwest
mm-hmm.
Accrediting something or other.
Mm-hmm.
And they all kind of have the same standards. But then some schools are nationally accredited, right? And could you just say something about the distinction there?
Well, the distinction is whether there's a distinction depends largely on which accrediting body you're talking about. So there are some national accreditors that have, you know, sort of general standards, much as regional accreditation does, and then there are other national accreditors that are very specific to a program, and so their standards are based really on the curriculum or the program content. So for me, there's a distinction between programmatic types of accreditation and sort of the general type of accreditation that's just the general sort of academic
quality.
What
would be an example of a program accreditation?
A nursing accreditation, for example, CCME or American Biblical Higher Education, where they're really just looking at the sort of religious content of the degree. And then a general would be ACICS or ASSET, which is health programs, but you know, it's not really specific to one type of program.
And some schools might have multiple accreditation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
So a nursing program within a larger university might be accredited both
through
the Northwest Regional and the National Nursing Board.
Correct.
But then there are other universities that are just generally accredited mm-hmm. by a national body
yes.
as opposed to a regional body.
Right. And the difference, you mentioned that most of the schools in Oregon would have Northwest Association. You'll find that most of the, and I can actually provide you a list of the accreditations that go with the colleges on this list if that's interesting. But you'll find that most of the schools that are outside of Oregon that are seeking or that have a campus in Oregon but they're operated from outside, for example, the for-profit colleges, will not have Northwest Association accreditation. They'll have Higher Learning Council accreditation, the North Central Association.
And is there any difference in the transferability of the courses, you know, for those institutions that are nationally accredited as opposed to regionally accredited? Do they transfer back and forth?
Transferability is determined by the school that's admitting the student. So while you could say that presumably there's no difference between regional accreditation and regional accreditation, you know, from any region, you'll find that a lot of schools will not admit students that have regional accreditation, or they won't accept the credit for the comparable course if the school is for profit, or if the regional accreditor is from another region, or if it's a national accreditor, or that kind of thing. I wanted to say that the national accreditations there's also a category that's called USDOE recognized accreditation. U.S. Department of Ed, and there are a lot of national accreditors that you'll find on that list and programmatic accreditors. We've struggled with, in the past, ODA has had processes whereby certain accreditors are recognized and others aren't, and then this U.S. Department of Ed recognition came along, and there's, you know, there's a question of whether, because that's eligible for financial aid, for Title IV, you know, has some eligibility connections, is that the way to go, or is regional accreditation? And so these are issues that I think we're grappling with in terms of, you know, we have some concerns, or we've had some concerns in the past about some of the schools that have just a programmatic accreditation, and perhaps the programmatic accreditation only concerns the content of the curriculum, but not the student support functions, you know, and those kinds of...
Yes, Rick Greenwood.
Why would the Astor Catholic College in Lebanon be accredited by you rather than Northwest process?
Because anytime a school is new, they are regionally accredited, but they're regionally accredited because they're originally from California. And so their main campus is in California, so they don't have Northwest Association accreditation or haven't had. And anytime a school starts in Oregon, and you'll notice on our list a lot of the small nonprofit colleges, and even, you know, they're on this list, and Walla Walla College, when a school first comes to Oregon and establishes a campus, they're under our oversight for 5 years. They've only been here for, I think, 2 or maybe 3 years. And so they'll have one more evaluation, and then they'll be exempt. And it's essentially, I think, you know, to establish that they meet Oregon standards, because even though those are, as I said, with the regional accreditation, the standards are the same, you know, we may have some different policies with relation to, you know, student support. So it kind of gives an opportunity. A lot of our role with regard to authorization is coaching schools sort of into, you know, this is how we do things here. Mm-hmm. And so there's great. There's just the connections with the licensing and that.
Rick Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question for you. Now, we've been talking about the school level and mm-hmm. whether something's accredited. If a student should take classes from a college and then run into the accreditation issue, mm-hmm. I've had stories of students who had done lower division work and then wanted mm-hmm. to transfer to one of our universities mm-hmm. and was told, sorry, that doesn't transfer, mm-hmm. Even though she'd put out a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Does the student have any recourse within the system to appeal that decision?
You know, we really don't have any way to work with that, and really, again, it's because the receiving institution is the one that makes the determination as to how those courses fit into their program. What you'll see quite often is students are, you know, the credits are admitted, or the credits are transferable as electives, but the student then still has to take the whole program, and often it's because, you know, perhaps there's some specific, you know, information, even in the lower division, that the school has, you know, a little bit of a different slant to their program, or they have a cohort model, so they really want the students to go through the entire curriculum. It's very complicated, but
it would really lie with the individual university.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Jennifer, we're going to have to mm-hmm. wrap up. So, and the issue of adverse impact, we're going to be taking up at another time. So,
yes.
But are there any highlights that you want to point out in these graphs that are here?
I think one of the things is just to notice sort of the pace of our workload has increased quite a bit, and a lot of this is due to the rise of online education and the need for approval of out-of-state, you know, the issues with licensing. I would mention a few highlights. One is that online programs tend to primarily be professional programs, so that's of interest, because I think, you know, often that licensing connection is really lost in the, well, why can't people just take online programs with regional accreditation? So that's where a lot of the issues are. The other thing is just that we're often thought of as the, you know, the office that handles for-profit colleges, and we also, there are quite a number, I didn't list the schools that used to be under us that aren't anymore, but schools like Oregon and College of Art and Crafts, Salem Bible College, Corbin University grew up sort of, you know, under ODA oversight first before they became independent institutions, and it really is a wonderful aspect of Oregon higher education that we have good standards and we have the ability to sort of grow our own colleges rather than, you know, requiring that a school come in and have, you know, the regional accreditation. So we, because of that, we have a very vibrant sort of small nonprofit sector that I think is often forgotten in the discussions because they're under ODA and we're not often remembered as having that group of schools. So
yeah, and I will say, just from my travels around the country, Oregon has a reputation of being a very rigorous state as far as oversight coming through the Office of Degree Authorization. We're really at the upper end of rigor. Thank Some you. People complain about that, by the way, but yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to follow up with your point dovetails with my question. And Jennifer, I'm wondering if within ODA, since the passage of 40-40-20 mm-hmm. and that aspirational goal for the state of Oregon, has there been or could there be a comprehensive conversation within the department to just do some self-examination about how equipped are you to facilitate that mm-hmm. process as we talk about greater frequency, greater volumes of degrees and degree authorization and so forth? And is a department prepared to perhaps adapt, if need be, to play a more facilitating role in that process, all of what Representative Dembro just referenced, that perhaps we have a reputation for being stringent's a good thing, but it could also be an inhibiting thing, too.
Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. I agree that it's always necessary to reevaluate, and we have actually done quite a bit of that in the past year. We worked with some of the schools in our sector, in fact, to do sort of an analysis of how we do our work and what we might be able to, you know, it's difficult sometimes in a time of transition to make those changes as quickly because we are part of a larger organization and that's all focused on 40-40-20, but over the next year I'm sure we'll be making significant changes and we're prepared to adapt to whatever we need to do to continue to be effective. And you know, of course we hope that we won't have to lower the standards provide less oversight than we have, because we hear from colleges that it's very supportive to them and that their programs are better, their student support services are better for having, you know, this sort of sounding board and support to do this, but we can always do a better job and we are always looking for ways to do that. So,
okay. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Last session we made some changes we actually made two changes last session as we were revising the function of the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. One of the things that we did was we moved the Office of Degree Authorization under the HEC, again, you know, in response to your comment, Rick Johnson, to make it part of that overall 40-40-20 operation, because 40-40-20 certainly, the focus of our attention is on the public colleges and universities, but there is a vital role for the private nonprofit and, other private providers within us getting to 40-40-20. The other thing that we did was, so Jennifer spoke to the degree-granting institutions, and that's one chunk of the independent and for-profit sector, but there are also a number of schools which are not offering degrees. Those are what we refer to as the career colleges, and those have been under the supervision of the Oregon Department of Education. The second thing that our bill last session did was create a process by which the two are going to be brought together, so that the single entity of the Office of Degree Authorization will be overseeing both the certificate-granting colleges and the degree-granting colleges. And, to help us understand that, our next panel includes two representatives from the Oregon Department of Education, Matt Barber, who has been directly responsible for this work, and also Jan McComb, who works with the State Board of Education. Jan, Matt, please come up.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jan McComb, the new legislative director for the Oregon Department of Education.
Really?
And today I'm substituting for Cindy Hunt, who caught a rather disabling virus over the weekend, and she can't speak. With me, as introduced by Chair Dembro, is Matt Barber. He's the compliance specialist with the department and team lead with the private career schools unit. And if it doesn't count against him, he's an attorney. So Matt has a presentation that will be an overview of the private career schools and licensing unit and provide you a foundation with the bills that are to come.
Just start.
these things. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, as Jan mentioned, my name is Matthew Barber. I'm team lead and a compliance specialist with the department. Unfortunately, PowerPoint is disagreeing with us.
Excuse me, could you move the microphone closer to you so pick up? Thank
okay. Name is Matthew Barber. I'm a compliance specialist for the Oregon Department of Education, team lead of the Private Career Schools Licensing Unit. We have some notes here that go along with the presentation. Unfortunately, PowerPoint is not letting me display those notes and the presentation on the screen, so may have to have a less clean view here. But here today to provide an overview of Oregon's private career schools and the work of the department's Private Career Schools Licensing Unit. Career schools are proprietary post-secondary institutions that offer career or vocational training. They are primarily for-profit institutions, but we do have a few nonprofits. The term career school is defined in Oregon statute at 345.010, meaning any proprietary institution that offers career or technical training for the purposes of instructing someone in pursuing a career or trade. The department licenses these institutions before they can offer instruction in Oregon. They are certificate-granting institutions, which means that they do not offer degrees such as an associate's or a bachelor's. We have about 223 career schools currently licensed in Oregon. They employ about 3,500 instructors and about 900 administrative and other support staff. The schools themselves enroll about 30,000 new students and graduate about 18,000 students each year. These students, when they graduate, are workforce ready, ready to go into a variety of careers. And their graduates contribute toward Oregon's middle 40 of the 40-40-20 goal. That's the 40% of the population that we expect to have either a two-year degree or a career credential.
Excuse me, Matt.
Vice Chair Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What becomes of the other 12,000 students per year, or are they losing 12,000? Are they continuing to grow in size because some take more time to get through the system?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Harker, what happens is that of the 223 schools we have, they offer a variety of programs that take very different amounts of time to complete. For example, a cosmetology school program could take 2 to 3 years, whereas a commercial truck driving class could take less than 6 months. So that has to be taken into consideration. So you might have more students enrolling than would be graduating because the students might be enrolling in a program that could take a longer period of time to complete.
I'll just keep watching for a graduation rate then.
Representative, did you have a question?
Same thing.
Okay. Go ahead.
That's what we need, completion.
Our career schools provide significant vocational and technical training opportunities in a diverse set of fields. That includes healthcare, insurance, tax preparation. It also includes real estate, cosmetology, commercial truck driving. We have a farrier school, floral arranging schools. It's a diverse group. The total number of licensees is down over the past 3 years. Schools close for a variety of reasons. To improve efficiency, if a school owner has 3 school sites, he or she may decide that it's more efficient based on the number of students they've been enrolling to reduce the number of school sites to 1 or 2 rather than 3. We license each site separately, so that can be accounting for. We've also had a few school owners who have decided to retire. There's no one to purchase the business or take it over. We've had one fellow who's been in business for 50 years, and he's just decided he'd like to retire and spend a little more time with his family.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Can I go back to Representative Harker's question, because I'm troubled by the same number. Did that 30,000 mean you enroll 30,000 new students a year, or there are 30,000 enrolled
at any one time?
Let's say new. sentence is a little ambiguous.
They are enrolling about 30,000 new students each year, so about 30,000 students, give or take, each year are enrolling in a career school program.
And 18,000 graduate each year.
About 18,000 are graduating from the program.
So I have the same question that Representative Harker has. What's the state of the other 12,000 students? Have they dropped out?
Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlich, some have dropped out, not all have dropped out, but again, that's because we're looking at this as a whole, but it's not really fair to look at it a whole in one way because, again, one career school might offer a program that's 3 years long. So they might be enrolling students, but those students won't be graduating within a year. They'll be graduating within three. Another career school will be enrolling students, but those students will be graduating within 6 months. So it's not going to be exact. You're not going to have the same number of students graduating each year as enrolled.
Well, do you have a follow-up on that? I think this is a critical issue, and that's why I think Representative Harkin raised it. How many students, what's the average total enrollment in any 1 year?
Representative Dembo, Representative...
We mean like there'd be like 60,000 or something totally.
Are you asking how many students are currently enrolled at all 223 schools right at this moment?
Exactly. The same basis that the 30,000 and the 18,000 come from. You get 30,000 going in and you've got 18,000 coming out. So if they're all still studying, you've got 60 or 70,000 students in there that have ganged up over the time. Or if you have 12,000 a year that enroll and don't ever come out, then that's sort of a different situation. So the question is, what's your average census of students?
Representative Dembro, I'm sorry, Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlich, I don't have that information with me, but we will research it back at the department and try to get an answer to you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think, again, the question is, what's the dropout rate?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how many students are successfully completing what they set out to complete? I think that's really the nub of the matter.
No.
Yeah. Thanks.
Function we meet every year. That was the damn thing about meeting every year. Yeah.
Just like to point out this nice, the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce produced a report in June of last year, and they found that graduates of these career schools, these certificate programs, will earn on average 20% more than individuals who just have a high school diploma as their highest level of education. These annual earnings can average up to $240,000 more over a lifetime. That results in more income to the individual who received the training, more benefits to their communities, increased tax revenues, a lot of benefits from the training. What does the Career School Licensing Unit do? We license the career schools that operate in Oregon. We approve the programs that are offered by existing schools, and we approve programs offered by license applicants. We investigate and respond to complaints regarding career schools. These can be complaints brought by students. These can be complaints brought by community members. And we provide significant technical assistance to licensees and applicants for a career school license. At present, we are processing about 17 new school applications. Those are applications for a new school license, and expect at least 7 more within the next few weeks. Our goals during the licensing process are to ensure that Oregon's career schools maintain a high level of quality. We help them be successful providers of career training, and we protect students' investment of time and money. Currently, what we're doing, we have adopted within the past 3 years an instructional model for schools to use. This is a model that was designed by the Wisconsin Technical College System specifically for schools offering career training. We're working to streamline our new license application process, which consists of 8 separate steps. That process walks license applicants through each step of the process and everything they need to do in order to operate a successful school. That would be walking them through developing an admissions process, student contracts, more commonly known as enrollment agreements, questions about what their transfer credit policy is going to be, developing a school catalog, things like that. Recently, we started reaching out to community partners in order to provide more assistance and services to our licensees. We've communicated with the Small Business Development Center at Chemeketa, and we're trying to provide more information about small business development centers throughout the state. These small business development centers provide advisors, training, assistance with starting up and operating a business. Also, within the past few days, we've had a conversation with Professor Warren Binford over at the Willamette University College of Law. The College of Law operates a business law clinic where second and third year law students who are supervised by a licensed attorney can provide basic services to individuals looking to start up a business so they can assist with, you know, choosing a business entity, getting it formed, things like that. But these are areas where our licensees can really benefit from having the assistance to these resources. In terms of technical assistance, we provide substantial technical assistance. When our licensees have questions about accreditation, U.S. Department of Ed regulations regarding financial aid, any question under the sun, they present it to us. So we have provided a significant amount of technical assistance. Recently, we've been providing a lot of technical assistance regarding the Americans with Disabilities Act and Oregon Revised Statute Chapters 659 and 659A, because a lot of our schools are unclear about what their obligations are under the ADA and Oregon law. So we've been trying to provide them with resources so they can become better informed about what their responsibilities are and how they can meet those responsibilities. And we've also been providing significant assistance with application materials, because the application does walk you through each step necessary to open a successful school. A lot of our applicants have experience working in the education field. We try to help them with the application materials as much as we can. The licensing unit of the department is funded through the fees it collects for issuing career school licenses, teacher registrations, copies of transcripts, and license renewal fees. It does not receive any dollars from the general fund. Our licensing fee schedule is set in statute at ORS 345.080. Our fee schedule has not been changed since 1999, 14 years ago. Unfortunately, our expenses have not remained at 1999 levels. To kind of put that into context, a child born in 1999 is now a high school freshman, and within a year, she'll be getting ready for her learner's permit. So it is a significant amount of time.
I sense you're going to be seeking a change to that, Matt.
Chair Dembro? Very correct. The licensing unit currently consists of three permanent positions and two limited duration positions. Those limited duration positions will be expiring on June 30th, 2012. Our permanent positions in the unit will be transferring over to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission when authority for the program transfers from the department to the commission on July 1st. The limited duration positions will not be transferring.
2013.
Chair Dembro, Representative Greenleaf, yes, the authority for regulating career schools and the licensing unit will be transferring from the department to the commission on July 1st.
This temporary position expiring in 2012, I assume
2013. Chair Dembro, Representative Greenleaf, the limited duration positions expire this year on June 30th, 2013.
They have already expired.
No, sir, they will expire on June 30th. So a few more months from now.
2013.
2013, yes. Apologies if I said 2012.
You just want to show you're listening, right?
I did, every once in a while. I want to show I'm still awake with the lights out.
Go ahead.
Effectively, we have a staff of about four doing the work of eight. Staffing has not kept pace with the unit's work and responsibilities, and our fees are not sufficient to cover the cost of hiring additional staff or personnel. The discrepancy between staffing and workload responsibilities has resulted in long delays in reviewing and approving new license applications. It is now between 6 to 12 months. Not all that can be attributed to staffing problems, though. Part of it is also the quality of the application materials we receive. Application materials that are high quality when we receive them, applicants who are involved in the process who respond to questions, shorter time if the materials are low quality. Are there a lot of questions that are raised? That can increase the amount of time necessary to approve the application. The staffing problems have also led to a longer amount of time than we would like in responding to student complaints, and has also resulted in staff being able to make fewer site visits to the schools that we license. We have an office specialist position that was left unfilled as a cost savings measure, but that just means that person's work responsibilities have been doled out among the remaining members of the unit. We have proposed a fee increase for 2013. We anticipate that the fee increase will generate about $150,000 in new revenue. This revenue would be used to hire at least one new additional full-time position. This additional position would help reduce our backlog, but would not eliminate it. We would probably need an additional three positions to eliminate the backlog. And then it's been mentioned that we're transferring to the commission. The governor, in his balanced budget, has proposed a new Department of Post-Secondary Education. The licensing unit and the state approving agency, along with other higher education agencies in Oregon, would be transferred to the new department under the governor's proposal. And then the state approving agency, the SAA, what is that? The state approving agency is appointed by the governor pursuant to a contract between Oregon and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. It is not part of the career school licensing unit, but it is, like the licensing unit, housed at the Oregon Department of Education. The SAA approves accredited degree and certificate programs offered by private for-profit institutions. So that would be schools overseen by the licensing unit and the Office of Degree Authorization. The SAA approves those schools for participation in VA educational benefit programs. So if a veteran wanted to use their educational benefits at a school in Oregon, that school would need to be approved by the state approving agency.
Matt, if I can interrupt. So will that operation move over to the HEC as well, or to the new department?
Chair Dembro, in the governor's balanced budget, it was indicated that the SAA would be moving along with the career school licensing unit to the new department. Okay. But the decision where to place the SAA lies in the governor's office. Each state is requested by the VA to create and maintain a state approving agency to review the applications for approval to participate in VA benefits. And the VA, the SAA office is funded completely with federal dollars earned under the contract. The state approving agency oversees about 20 ODA schools. That's 16 accredited and 4 non-accredited degree granting institutions, 41 career schools overseen by the career school licensing unit, and 4 high schools. The reason the high schools are on there, children of eligible veterans can receive benefits, but as we all know, seniors can hit 18. At 18, they're no longer eligible to receive benefits, so this allows children of veterans who hit 18 while they're still in high school to continue receiving benefits for a few more months. In these instances, the state approving agency is only approving the student's program. They're not actually approving the high school. And if you have any questions, we have a website, ode.state.or.us/go/PCS. And if the committee has any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Yes, Rick Gallegos.
I don't know if it's under the purview of the offices now or the new department, but this committee is very concerned about student debt. And so I'm curious if you have any information with regard to debt load of students in these programs, especially if we could compare it to public school debt load. And also, I'd be interested in knowing the degree to which these private programs have their own finance offices, that kind of thing.
Okay. Chair Dembro, Representative Gagos? Gagos. We don't have that information right now, but we can look into getting it for you. While we don't necessarily track that debt or potentially have the ability to, one of the things we do with our licensees is we have requirements that they have to provide information about the cost of the program, the complete cost of the program, up front in their promotional materials like school catalogs. So they have to announce the cost of tuition, books and other charges, admissions and enrollment fees, things like that, any other fees that may come into effect. as well as their refund policies. We have adopted, by administrative rule, default cancellation and refund policies that schools have to use, or if they don't want to use them, they can use something that provides more protection to a student, and then we will allow them to use something that provides more protection to a student.
We will actually be exploring that issue a little further a week from today at our hearing. Matt, is there any chance you could get us some information by next Monday?
Chair Dembo, we will work on that.
Okay, thank you very much. The other thing, as I recall, that that exists for the private career colleges is that they have to put up some kind of bond, don't they, in case they go out of business, and your agency has some kind of oversight of that.
Chair Dembo, we don't require our licensees or existing schools to have a bond. One of the things we do take a look at when they're applying for license and on license renewals, we take a look at the financial health of the business to see if it looks like it'll be sustainable, if it looks like it'll have enough money to provide both the resources necessary to offer the instruction as well as provide refunds to students who may decide to withdraw, drop out, transfer to another program. Yes, and then we also oversee a tuition protection fund.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Right. At the time of initial licensure, license applicants will pay a licensing fee. They will also then, towards the eighth step, provide a capitalization deposit is what we call it. It's their initial payment into the state's tuition protection fund. The tuition protection fund is operated by the department for the purpose of protecting students in case a school that they are attending, a career school, closes down before the student has completed their program of instruction. We can make refunds from the fund, or students can use the money to then pay for completing their program of instruction at another school. Payments into the TPF, schools have to make about 14 to 16 semi-annual payments into the fund. The amount of the payments is based on a fee schedule that's very similar to the licensing fee schedule. So if they have a good year and they're earning more in gross tuition income, they would pay more into the TPF. If it's a leaner year, they would be paying less. But that exists to protect the students.
And has that fund been used?
On occasion, it has been used. To my knowledge, it has not been used within the past 2 or 3 years. And we haven't made any payouts. We have in the past made payouts from the fund. Oh, and to get back to your question about the bond, if a school is not sufficiently capitalized after reviewing the records, they do have an option of putting up a bond. We will also accept letters of credit, and we do have one school that is going through the letter of credit approval process right now.
Okay, thank you. Okay, yes, Rep. President.
Thank you. Can you tell us what's happening here? There'll be another public hearing, and then we'll have...
We have hearings on a series of bills that relate to the career schools, and Matt is going to help us with that, I think. So, but before we get to that, I'd like to call Gary Conkling up,
I'd like to have a list of the committee members, and normally... Are you having anyone from the committee testify, or can we get a letter from the committee that says, you know, that they support this, but could we have a letter from the committee saying that they support all these bills?
Chair Dembro, Representative Wissat, we actually have the chair of the Private Career School State Advisory Committee here today. Kevin Lambert is here, so if the committee would like to hear from him, he's available to testify.
Well, we would, certainly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he represents a private institution, or?
Chair Dembro, Representative Wissat, Mr. Lambert, actually, would you like me to call him up now?
Why don't we have him come up and Gary come up?
Okay.
And does that make sense? Yeah. Just to look at all this from the perspective of the operators of the schools.
I noticed Jessica absent in the room. Are you getting along with your vice chairs? Because my experience was she only came in the room when there was a problem.
She's changed her role as representative. Now she creates the problem.
Move to the dark side.
Yeah. Jessica, were you going to want to come up as well?
Yes. Mr. Housing has it.
Okay, great. Okay, I don't know what makes sense. Which of you wants to go first?
I'll be happy to, because the microphone's in front of me.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time this morning. My name is Kevin Lambert, and I've been with private career schools for 30 years. I am the chairperson for the private career schools. I've been on the committee for 8 years. So I just am here to let you know what I see and support and answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, great.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Follow up that. Sir, now we're looking for your input. You're paying the fees, so you know, you're supporting all these bills, the committee, and it's been testified in this committee this morning that some of the problem in their backlog is because of the applications. So is it structurally adequate for the applications, or is it just the person filling out the application? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your question. It is appropriate, the committee feels, to raise the fees. Matt is correct, they haven't been raised since 1999, and there does need to be more support to investigate complaints if there are any. That's a critical issue, to stop a school that might be doing something that's not correct.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Conkling. I'm here representing the Northwest Career Colleges Federation and its newly established Oregon chapter. Our chapter in Oregon represents largely the accredited schools and some of the certificate-issuing schools, but many of the certificate-issuing schools are not members of ours, at least in our federation. So my comments will speak to the sector broadly, but a lot of the information relates particularly to the schools that are degree granting and accredited. I just thought I'd give you a few bullet points, and then if I could just share a few of our agenda items, which I think relate to many of the discussion points that you've had today. The accredited for-profit post-secondary schools in Oregon account for 69% of the state's undergraduate certificates, 21% of the associate degrees, 8% of the bachelor's degrees, and 2% of the master's degrees based on 2009-2010 academic data. Our student bodies tend to be older and more financially independent than those in public and private nonprofit colleges and universities. Our students are typically mostly from Oregon. They are single parents, minorities, dislocated workers, people stuck in dead-end jobs, and returning veterans. Many have attended but not flourished in traditional post-secondary institutions. They come to our schools committed to get an education that makes a difference in their lives and for their families. Students choose our schools because they can get in, get out, and get a job. We offer smaller classes, flexible schedules, hands-on learning, and coursework tied to available jobs or professional licensing requirements in business, industry, and healthcare. Our schools in our particular federation train anything from truck drivers to registered nurses, apparel designers, and electrical engineers. More than 85% of our students qualify for need-based student aid, and 63% receive federal Pell Grants. None of our students receive Oregon Opportunity Grants. All of our students have the assurance of a tuition protection fund, which you heard about moments ago, in case of one of our schools fails to perform, and that fund is financed through revenues that we put into it. Oregon degree-granting career colleges undergo rigorous state regulation, as well as regional or national accreditation, as you've also heard today. Certificate-issuing schools also undergo rigorous review. Our schools receive no state aid, but they do pay state and local taxes. We are not the largest post-secondary sector in Oregon, nor are we trying to be, but as Mr. Barber mentioned, we are one of the crucial sectors in helping Oregon achieve its 40-40-20 goal. The gap in meeting the second 40 is so large that we need all hands on deck including schools such as ours with capacity, access to private capital, and the flexibility to adapt quickly to evolving industry needs. So if I may, Mr. Chair, with your leave, just briefly touch on our agenda items here, which I think are, again, relevant to your consideration both today and later. First off, we would like to see, as the state is looking at realignment in its post-secondary assets and entities, a streamlined and unified regulation of the entire for-profit college sector. This would avoid regulatory duplication, speed decisions, leverage existing staff, and use fee revenue economically. We support rigorous regulation of our sector, but we also want that decision-making to be timely and based on clear criteria. We support equalizing Oregon's Opportunity Grant, so all qualified Oregon students receive need-based financial aid regardless of their choice of college. This has nothing to do with the business model of a college. It has everything to do with making college accessible and affordable to some of Oregon's most needy and most dedicated students. Recognizing and including some of our career colleges in plans to achieve the state's goals of a well-trained adult population in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, as well as a range of technical and medical fields, also seems like a prudent step. We can be a useful player. We support fair and reasonable fees for regulation of our sector, but also want to ensure that the share is fairly distributed between in-state colleges with brick-and-mortar campuses and out-of-state online course providers based on workload. And finally, we are willing and eager to participate in work groups of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission on important issues, including credit for prior learning, and in our case, the issue of credit transferability among institutions, so that students have the greatest flexibility in pursuing certificates and degrees that meet their needs and also the needs of industry in the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Conklin. Any questions? Yes, Mr. Chair Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Carrie, thanks for that info. On the one side of the page, you say that over 85% qualify for need-based student aid, 63% receive Pell Grants. The other side talked about access to the Opportunity Grant. Can you tell me, I don't know the amount of a Pell Grant in terms of how much it provides, what portion of tuition it would cover in one of in a representative program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I'm not able to give you that specific information, but I'd be glad to give you a couple of examples. It doesn't cover the entire tuition, but it helps. Similarly, the Oregon Opportunity Grant does. I mean, it's a fixed amount of money that makes a difference and certainly lowers the debt load for a student that has to finance it.
Other questions? Gary, one of the things that we're trying to get a handle on is, the vulnerability that students have to take on too much debt, right? And there are various ways to look at that. One of the indicators of that somebody has perhaps taken on too much debt is when they end up not being able to repay their loans, end up defaulting on their loans. Nationally, the default rate in the for-profit sector is, I think, 23-24%, close to 1 in 4. Do you have a sense of what the default rate is here in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Diallo was conducting a survey among our members, which I encouraged our members to participate in to the greatest extent possible to provide state-based information. There's no question that student debt overall in all sectors of higher education, regardless, but including ours, is a concern. And default rates are a concern, not, again, just in our sector, but across the board. A number of our schools, because we are similar as private institutions to our colleagues in the independent nonprofit sector, offer scholarships and a variety of other financial means, including one of our institutions offers a lifetime renewal that you can come back for free to upgrade your skills. So there are efforts to try to add greater value, but there's no question that many of our students are financially vulnerable. They usually are out on their own or don't have parents who are capable of providing assistance to them. And some of them, because of life circumstances, just aren't able to handle it. I wished I could paint a better picture for you, but the data is not inaccurate. I don't know that it completely tells the whole life stories of the people involved, but nonetheless, it's still a concern that we all share.
You know, my mother was in the hospital a couple of weeks ago. She had complications from pneumonia. So I found myself watching a lot more daytime TV than I'm used to. And it seemed as if every 5 minutes there'd be another ad for a different for-profit college. I'm just wondering, do we have a sense of how much of the students' tuition is actually going into marketing and advertising and, you know, expenses not directly related to the classroom or student support?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that there's a universal answer to that. I think it varies. And I'm sorry about your mother being in the hospital.
She's doing better. Thank you.
I, by the way, happen to have a 17-year-old daughter who's attending Jesuit High School. And every day, our mailbox is full of invitations to go to different schools throughout the country. I don't think it is universal or unique to our sector to advertise. The particular kind of advertisement that you see in a daytime television setting is because the segment is often, that's the way they reach the student body. They don't do very much direct mail like Willamette or University of Oregon does. So it's just a different segmentation to reach their audience.
Thank you. Rep. Gagas.
Yeah, I have a question about your last bullet there on the second side of
yes.
the page relating to credit for prior learning. My experience, as we heard before, in terms of the many levels of accreditation, national and regional, that credit for prior learning is pretty much a prohibited or not considered legitimate area to provide credit. How critical is that to the for-profit schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallegos, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission was assigned the issue of looking at credit for prior learning. While that isn't necessarily the aspect of the issue that is relevant to the career college, the issue which I think several of you have raised about credit transferability, which is a cousin to that issue, is really our issue. And there's no question it is tied up with perceptions and decisions that are made on the basis of how schools are accredited. Many of our schools, because they have a national ownership, some of them are publicly traded, are accredited at a national level because it makes sense for them to be accredited at a national level or not just here. They don't just have a campus here. They have a campus here, but not just here. By objective standards, many believe that sometimes that national accreditation is as good or better than some regional accreditations. That's not a reflection on the Northwest, but some other regional accreditation groups in the country. Whether it is or isn't, it seems like a separate question. We, in Oregon, impose a second level of review, which we support, through the Office of Degree Authorization. And we believe that it is a guarantee to Oregon students and to policymakers such as yourself, as well as the employers of our graduates, that you're getting a legitimate graduate who knows what they're talking about. Today, however, we can have students, for whatever their reasons, that may want to transfer between a school in our sector and a community college or another public institution, and the accreditation and the transferability of credits impedes their ability to do that. And we're saying that appreciate it's not an easy issue to achieve that level of articulation, even among the public institutions. There have been arguments about that. But we think that it's worthwhile, and on behalf of Oregon students, it is worth looking at in some way. So we're encouraging you to do that. Sorry for the long answer, but it's a very important issue.
Right. Thank you, Gary. And we will be getting that report from the HEC task force on it, and we'll be discussing it. Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Kevin and Matt, could you stay up there as we march through the bills? So I am going to close the informational hearing on career colleges and the work of the ODA. And I'm going to open hearings. I'm going to open a concurrent hearing on all of these bills, and that is House Bill 2185, House Bill 2186, House Bill 2187, House Bill 2188, House Bill 2189, House Bill 2190, House Bill 2191. As you can see, they were all introduced at the same time, since they're sequential.
There's a common theme in them all.
Yes. Okay, so Victoria, well, why don't we go at them one at a time? So, Victoria, could you tell us what House Bill 2185 is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2185 authorizes the State Board of Education to collect non-refundable licensing fees for administration of licensing program for career schools.
Okay. So this is the fee bill that we are charged with evaluating and commenting on and then passing on to Ways and Means, which the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education will be looking at it from a, you know, from a Ways and Means perspective. And does anybody have any questions about this? Matt sort of introduced the need for it, which Kevin confirmed. Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'll be submitting an amendment. I have a bill that Senator Johnson and I are dropping that no fees can be increased without legislative approval. That's a legislative function. And that bill, we're meeting annually now, and agencies should be able to figure their budgets without, during that time, without, and have a legislative oversight. So I will submit an amendment to the committee for consideration to delete, allowing the Board of Education to determine future fee increases by rule.
Do you have any response to that, Matt?
Chair Dembo, Representative Wisnat, the legislature already has a role in with when it comes to fee revenue. An agency may establish by rule a fee that it will charge for issuing a license or something like that, and that fee revenue is collected and goes into the fund. The legislature, though, when it comes time to apportion out or the agency's budget, makes a decision of how much of that collected money the agency will receive. So the this wouldn't be taking the legislature's role in that process out.
No fee increase can be made by state agencies according to this bill that Senator Johnson and I are proposing, except by legislative action.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Representative, let me ask you, are you saying that you're proposing a separate bill that would apply to all fees? And has that bill been drafted?
Started. Yes, sir. In the Senate.
Okay. So it's coming through the Senate?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, anybody have any further questions about House Bill 2185? And by the way, just to clarify, today we're having a public hearing on these bills. We don't have a work session scheduled for today. That will be subsequent based on our conversations. Okay. All right, let's move to House Bill 2186 then. Victoria, what can you tell us about this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2186 allows Superintendent of Public Instruction to investigate career schools, clarifies terms of probation, suspension, and revocation for licensees of career schools.
Okay, Matt, what is the problem here that this is trying to solve?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, House Bill 2186 is a housekeeping bill. It provides a technical fix to ORS 345.120 to align the use of license suspension in that statute with how license suspension is used in other statutes, such as Volume 15 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which deals with licensing occupations and professions. Presently, in our statute, if a career school licensee is placed on suspension, they can continue to use that license to do the career for which the license is necessary. But there are conditions imposed on the use. They can't advertise, they can't recruit. This is different from how license suspension is used in almost every other context. In other professions, if your license is suspended, you can no longer do the work for which the license was required. However, if your license is placed on probation, you can continue to use the license, but you may be subject to conditions. What we're trying to do with this technical fix in House Bill 2186 is to move our use of suspension in the career school statutes into alignment with how it's used almost everywhere else in the ORS. The bill does this in two ways. First, it makes clear that if a licensee is placed on suspension, they can't use their license to engage in the career for which the license is required. And second, it clarifies that when a licensee is placed on probation, they can continue to use that license, but there may be conditions attached, such as on advertising to new students or recruiting and enrolling new students.
Thank you.
And I should mention that when this was previously introduced, it was supported by the Oregon Department of Justice.
Right. And just for a bit of history, it did pass unanimously out of this committee. That this was when it was a subcommittee, and then it died in the full education committee along with a plethora of other bills. So,
these were filed by the as education committee bills, the whole set of them?
Yes. Back in 2011, and then we had a subcommittee. Yeah.
Who filed these bills?
The Oregon Department of Education. The governor for the Oregon Department of Education filed them.
The House Interim Committee on Education.
Is that how they were introduced?
Chair Dembro?
Yes.
Representative Greenlick. The department sponsored a bill, Senate Bill 103, which contains a lot of the similar provisions to the seven bills we're discussing today. The seven were previously introduced during the 2011 session. The House bills, though, while the department sponsor requested approval to submit the Senate Bill 103, the House bills were introduced at the request of the House Higher Ed Committee, or the interim committee, but similar content, just different vehicles.
The Interim Committee on Education.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's just how they went through. We put through some education bills. They put through some higher education bills. It was just for practicality of scheduling.
I'm just trying to track who's really behind these.
This is the department. These are bills coming out of the Department of Education.
Okay, that's what I was looking for.
Okay, 2188. 87. Oh, we didn't do 87. Okay, 87, sorry.
House Bill 2187 allows career schools to be regulated by agencies other than the Department of Education, establishes requirements for transitioning schools from Department of Education regulation to regulation by other agencies or reverse.
Okay, Matt, talk about this one.
All right. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, House Bill 2187 would establish a process by which the Department of Education could transfer authority to oversee a career school to another state agency. The example I'll use today is schools that provide instruction in certified nursing assistant programs. Those programs are overseen by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. The State Board of Nursing has expressed some interest in taking over, assuming oversight for those programs. House Bill 2187 would establish a process by which the department, through the deputy superintendent, could make a determination as to whether the other state agency has developed a process and procedures that are similar to what the department oversees under ORS 345-325 to protect students' interests, and then transfer authority for overseeing the school from the department to the other state agency. It also sets up an additional process by which the other state agency, if it decides that it no longer wants to have oversight of that school, can transfer it back to the department.
Okay. And so this is the one that's dealing with the nurse, the Board of Nursing, the CNAs?
Yeah. Yes.
Actually, Jim, would you mind coming up? I'm going to call up Jim Carlson from the Healthcare Association.
Did you review the bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Carlson, President of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a 501c6 not-for-profit trade association representing about 670 or 80 licensed long-term care providers. Nurse aid training programs are governed under federal law and then administered locally under a contract with the federal government by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. It's called NATCEP, stands for Nurse Aid Training Competency Evaluation Programs. All states have to have programs in place to meet minimum federal requirements regarding the training of certified nursing assistants and certified medical medication assistants and aides. We still have some concerns with some of the language in House Bill 2187 that we believe needs to be addressed. We are having an amendment drafted to address it. Specifically, if you look at on the bill, page 2, it makes the ability to exempt these programs. It's a may, it's not a shall. May grant an exemption. We're also concerned that in the timeline on this process, as was indicated in testimony earlier, there may be delays incurred in timeline in which they're granting this authority to other state agencies and the like. So we will have some amendments speaking specifically to the current programs that have been administered by the Oregon State Board of Nursing successfully for several decades. And I believe, Mr. Chair, that represents the Oregon State Board of Nursing, were following up and in contact with you last week about their oversight of the program.
Right. Yeah. And we have just received an amendment, and I don't know if this does what you are hoping to, but it's something we'll certainly look at and share with the Board of Nursing before we have the work session. This was an area where back in 2011 we did not move this to a work session because there was just some disagreement between the Board of Nursing and the Department of Education, and we just need to make sure we're all on the same page with this.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. And we will have some comments later on similar around House Bill 2191 related back to the programs governed and administered by the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks. Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The language that I'm seeing on the background about the measure refers to agencies, multiple. Everything I'm hearing talked about is about nursing. So how widespread is this? Are we talking, we're talking about granting multiple agencies the responsibility for dealing with these schools? Is it really, in fact, only the nursing school department agency, etc.?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Harker, the bill is structured broadly because it's not, while the State Board of Nursing has been the most vocal about requesting this authority, other agencies have expressed some interest and may want to participate at a later date once they see how it works. The way it's structured right now is the other agency would have to adopt sufficient student protections similar to those that the department oversees that are adopted in statute. And the State Board of Nursing did do that through administrative rule. They instituted a series of protections through administrative rule that are very similar to what we administer under ORS 345-325. We've actually already started working with them. Statute currently allows the deputy superintendent to exempt a school from licensure if the superintendent finds that they are adequately regulated by other means. Because the State Board of Nursing adopted those rules that are very similar to ours, we found that they were, those schools did provide, were adequately regulated by other means, and we have exempted some of the primarily nursing homes offering certified nursing assistant programs from regulation. The students are protected by the State Board of Nursing. There's also protection because students who are enrolled in those certified nursing assistant programs offered at nursing assistant facilities have tuition protection through the U.S. government. I believe it's through the Medicare program. If the facility hires that individual and the student starts as an employee, they aren't charged tuition. It's paid through Medicare. And if they are hired within a year of having taken the course, tuition is refunded. They get the course is paid through Medicare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would just want to see the breadth of these agencies that we would be granting this right to before we go down that path and make perhaps cast too broad a blanket.
Thank you. May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
After what,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just following again with Representative Harker. I think it's a great question. I understand that the situation is with the Board of Nursing and it's triggered this and you're addressing that, but back to his question, give an example of other agencies you mentioned who are interested, because I'm not worried so much about this relationship and the possibility of amendments that please the group, but it's the scope.
Chair Denver, Representative Gilman. Other agencies that have oversight of career schools that we license would be the Oregon Insurance Division, the Oregon Real Estate Agency, Oregon Health Licensing Agency through their Board of Cosmetology. Each of those agencies has adopted administrative rules related to the schools they oversee. I do not know if presently they would be interested in taking on full oversight from the department, but if the option is available to them, they may want to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's
a good question. Okay, thank you. And Jim, since you're still up here, on the amendment that has been proposed, this one will specifically call out the certified nursing assistant, right?
Mr. Chair, our intent was to just be very narrow in the scope of our amendment and to not interfere with other aspects of the bill, but to specifically address the concern related to the nurse aid training programs administered by the Oregon State Board of Nursing under the agreement with the federal government.
Okay. And Matt, what do you think of that strategy of having this bill just very narrowly addressing that one situation?
Chair Dembro, since at the present the State Board of Nursing is, to my knowledge, the only state agency that has expressed interest in participating in the program, that seems reasonable, but I have not had that conversation with my superiors at the department.
Okay. We'll try to get as much input as we can before we vote on this. Okay. Thank you for your questions, colleagues. All right, moving on to 2188. What is this one, Victoria?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2188 allows Superintendent of Public Instruction to retain reasonable costs related to investigation and assessment of career school civil penalties.
Okay, Matt, I suppose this has to do with the capacity of your agency?
Chair Dembro, in a way, yes. The department is tasked by the legislature with protecting students and other schools, and that means investigating violators of Oregon's career school laws. Pursuing those violators can get expensive. Within the past few years, we have had significant legal expenses involved in pursuing these violators. Occasionally, we've had to hire experts. Most recently, we had to hire a forensic accountant to help us investigate a complaint against a school. When the department assesses civil penalties against a licensee after making the determination that they have engaged in a violation of the career school laws, those civil penalties go into the general fund. That means that we are burdened with the expenses of pursuing those violators. Those costs are to our revenues. Our revenues are already insufficient to provide sufficient staff. So that's just an additional hit to our budget. If we were allowed to keep a portion of the civil penalties to cover the costs that we incurred pursuing those violators, that would free up scarce resources to continue providing technical assistance and services to the schools and to the students.
Chair, I
have
a question.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Thank you. I bet you can answer it. I'm confused due to our action last session. Who is the superintendent of public insurance?
The governor.
So when we refer to the superintendent, we're also referring to the governor in this bill.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gilman. Yes, the governor is the superintendent, but the deputy superintendent of public instruction is the head official for the Department of Ed.
Right. Actually, I have a good question. So presumably, when your department moves over to the Office of Degree Authorization under the HEC, the superintendent would be replaced by someone else here, right?
Chair Dembrough, when the licensing unit transfers over to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission on July 1st, if you take a look at the bill in front of you, Legislative Council has done an excellent job of doing double amendments. They have amended existing statutes to provide that when this change happens, it refers to the superintendent or deputy superintendent. And then the double amendment is addressing the laws that will be in effect once the licensing unit transfers over to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. All the differences that are then to the commission.
Great, thank you. Okay, any questions about this? This seems like a very reasonable request. Although I was looking forward to your agency for closing our general fund budget gap, but I guess maybe that's unfair. Okay, House Bill 2189.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2189 allows the State Board of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to adopt rules related to general governance and operation of career schools, allows rules adopted to be specific to individual professions provided by career schools, modifies statutory language related to training requirements for hair design, barbering, aesthetics, and nail technology.
Okay, Matt, you want to speak to this?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, House Bill 2189 would allow the State Board of Education, which has rulemaking authority for the licensing unit, to adopt administrative rules for the general governance of career schools as well as adopt administrative rules for specific program administration. The need for this is that the department oversees schools in which there is no standard curriculum. Most prominent example is our phlebotomy schools. No state agency that we have found regulates the practice of phlebotomy. There are two or three national organizations, private national organizations, that offer certification programs and exams, but those entities only provide oversight for the certification programs that they offer. So for program-specific adoption, this would allow the department to specifically adopt administrative rules for those academic programs where there isn't either a state agency that provides oversight or there isn't some unified national board. This would allow the department, in the case of phlebotomy schools, to perhaps adopt an administrative rule indicating that the phlebotomy curriculum adopted by the American Red Cross Association or prescribed by the American Red Cross Association is a standard, and that phlebotomy school curriculum should be able to meet that standard or exceed it. This measure is also necessary because we also oversee career schools that provide training in non-traditional careers. Again, the most prominent example is the schools that provide instruction in training in modeling and acting. There is no general curriculum for those matters, so allowing us to adopt specific standards for those schools to address their specific needs would help us provide better services to those schools. The bill also contains a housekeeping measure. 3 years ago, we adopted an instructional model that was designed by the Wisconsin Technical College System specifically for institutions that provide career training. It's called the Worldwide Instructional Design System, or WIDS. Under the WIDS model, one of the elements that schools must identify is competencies, the tasks and skills the students must be able to perform and the level of quality at which they must perform them. This has caused a bit of confusion for some of our schools because under our instructional model, they have to identify their competencies, but in our statutes for our cosmetology schools, they can be competency-based programs. So what the bill attempts to do is just do a little bit of housekeeping to reduce confusion. It changes competency-based programs in statute to proficiency-based. And we think that reducing confusion for our licensees would benefit everyone.
Thank you. Kevin, do you have any problems with that?
No, I don't. I think it's supported by the committee, and it makes sense.
Thank you. Any questions about this? Okay, then let's move on to 2190. Victoria?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2190 requires the State Board of Education to adopt minimum standards related to the financial soundness of owners of career schools, allows board to consider financial condition of owners when establishing payment schedules for the Tuition Protection Fund, creates licensure contingencies for unpaid fees.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, one of the things we ask applicants for a new school license when they submit their materials is we ask some questions about the business's financial condition. And in the case of individual, to pick an example, tax preparation schools. Often tax preparation schools are operated by individuals who own tax preparation businesses, and they run the schools out of the tax preparation office. The tax preparation office provides the equipment, the space, the chairs, the tables, the pens. Everything is pretty much paid for out of the preparation office's account. So the school itself has very little, but they don't always tell us that's the case. They don't always tell us that their school is being subsidized either by their own personal accounts or by their existing businesses' accounts. What this measure would allow us to do is to take a look at an individual's overall financial condition. If we receive materials that indicates that the school has maybe $500 in its own account, that would raise a red flag for us, indicating that the school's not sufficiently capitalized. But if an individual comes in and tells us, well, I'm actually going to be paying the school's expenses and everything else out of this business account that oversees the school, then this would give us authority to take a look at their records and make a determination as to whether or not that individual or that business is sufficiently capitalized to provide that protection and to provide those services to the students.
Thank you. Rip Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, please, if this bill has been prompted by one or more events, or is this just the observation that you might need to go in and look at these things? And what were those events, please?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Harker, this bill was inspired by events. Often when we receive a new license application from some of our, we call them pre-licensed schools. These are career schools that offer training for a specific career that requires licensure. Mm-hmm. The schools mm-hmm. include exam and license preparation. Those schools are often run out of somebody's existing business, but they don't provide us with the financial data. So that raises questions. Then we have to have a conversation with them, and then they say, well, can I just give you my business's corporate tax information so you have all this?
So could you give us an example?
Yeah, a specific example of how this
you don't need to name, you don't need to name
how this school. Again, I would go to the tax preparation schools. We did see a school who submitted information that indicated they had no school site, no equipment, a couple $1,000 in the bank. We asked them questions about that. They told us what the schools are operating out of the office. Then they said, well, I can give you my business's financial information. You can take a look at that. And we've always been very willing to accept that information because it makes sense for our licensees. The problem is that we're not confident that we would like the statute clarified to make it clear that we can request that information, we can receive it when those situations arise. Because otherwise then we may not have it may be questionable for us to request that, but we could accept it if it was offered. So there's the difference there between accepting and us making the request.
Okay, great. Yes, Kevin?
The committee looked at this and thought, you know, there needs to be a fine-tuning of the microscope from time to time. And this allows that fine-tuning to take place to see what the rest of the story is for the structure that the school is operating under. And most people are willing to share the rest of their tax returns or a balance sheet, perhaps, to show that they're of substance and can carry on the operation of the school.
Your committee is very concerned about, you don't want new schools that are going to bring down the reputation of the existing schools, right? I mean, that's a...
Absolutely right. Everybody in the school business for the most part, the operators are very honest and hardworking people and do an excellent job. We want to protect the school industry and the reputation that it has. And so we want to do everything we can to get to the bottom of the story and make sure that the unscrupulous operators are no longer allowed to operate. And as was mentioned earlier, the tuition protection fund hasn't been used in 3 years. That's a good sign that the schools that are operating now are good schools.
Thank you. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder what kind of an objective process could be employed here to ensure that there wouldn't be any sort of subjectivity to an examination? Is there any sort of template that you could apply to everyone to ensure that their company's in good standing, solvent, that sort of a thing?
Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, when we're taking a look at a school's finances, we're looking to make sure that they are sufficiently capitalized to be able to provide the instruction they're offering and to provide tuition refunds to students in case students request a refund. That's what we're taking a look at. We usually look for about the ability to make about 6 months' worth of tuition refunds in case it needs to happen. So that establishes a floor. We do not at the moment have a model that we would be looking at that would be applied to everyone in every type of school.
Just seeing that that might help overall if everyone knew what the litmus test was, so to speak, to be declared within a financial state, condition of good standing and so forth. Everybody could meet the same standard.
Although it might vary, school by or sector by sector,
correct.
But having standards does obviously make sense.
And Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, we do have a standard. The standard is, are you sufficiently capitalized to provide the instruction you're going to be offering for a school that's offering tax preparation training? That might be less than a school that's going to be offering instruction in cosmetology or phlebotomy. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, a one-size-fits-all may not work. But we do require that each school has to show that they have sufficient resources to provide the instruction they intend to offer. So we take a look to make sure that happens. And then we also look to make sure that they can provide a certain amount of tuition refunds to students. So we're taking a look at that sense, and that has been working.
And for me, it's just defining sufficient and what that means. So I'm sure you can work with that with business by end of business. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. There are no other questions. Let's move on to our final bill, which is House Bill 2191. And Victoria, if you could read us that. And Jim, maybe you or Dale could come back up for this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2191 expands the definition of agent for purpose of career schools to require schools to issue identification and registered agents to possess identification when engaged as an agent of a career school.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, House Bill 2191 is a housekeeping measure that would amend Oregon Revised Statute 345.010 and 345.070 to account for changes in technology and changes in employment practices. Presently, only an employee of a career school is considered to be an agent for that career school under our existing statutes. That means if a career school were to hire a contractor or contract with a contractor to serve the purposes of an agent, we would not have oversight of that individual because they're a contractor, they're not an employee. Also, by expanding the definition of agent in this bill, we would be taking into account technological changes. Nowadays, our career school licensees are beginning to use online services or technical service providers to function as agents. These can be websites. They will provide information about the school. Sometimes they can provide comparisons of one school to another. Sometimes they might even include interactive elements or bots that mimic to varying degrees of success, a human being who will answer certain questions from a student, maybe refer them to the client school. We don't have authority to regulate those technical service providers or keep an eye on them. So this bill would allow us to oversee contractors, the technical service providers, and it would also clarify that presently employees of career schools who are agents have to be licensed, they have to have a credential from their school. This bill would clarify that only employees or contractors would have to have that identifying credential, not the technological service providers.
Great, thank you. Jim, if you want to speak to your... There was a concern that this could have an unintended consequence on your industry.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson representing Oregon Healthcare Association again. Specific back to the nurse aide training programs overseen and administered by the Oregon State Board of Nursing, a number of years back, we identified with folks looking to enter nurse aide training or certified medication aid training programs that a lot of these folks weren't able to spend several weeks in a classroom receiving their training for their classroom portion of the training. And we had a lot of folks looking for career paths and opportunities. So we began development of an online training program, working very closely with the Board of Nursing on the curriculum and the content and the development of that. And we partnered with a technology partner, an e-learning one, to put it in the proper platform. We went through a very long process, probably at least 18 months or longer, to develop the content and the curriculum and to go through a very extensive approval process of this program with the Oregon State Board of Nursing. And it's the first and only certified nursing assistant online training program approved by a state board of nursing that I'm aware of yet in the country. And so we offer that right now through the roughly 80 training sites in the state that are made up of licensed nursing facilities. We have some hospitals and health systems, and then we have licensed the online training program curriculum to the Community College Consortium, and there are a handful of career schools that are utilizing that for the classroom portion of their training. What our concern is, or interest is, has the developer of the content and the curriculum, and we are not marketing any of this whatsoever. Our concern is that we're not brought into the legislation as an agent. If the entity who is doing the actual training of the individual is a career school, for example, and they, you know, meet the definition of agent, I think that's fine. But we believe the language in here that would be bringing in the contractors and others, and specifically I'm referring to in Section 1, Sub B, at the request of a career school or under contract with a career school, provides information technology services for the school and has control over information technology systems that are used for the purpose of procuring students, enrollees, or subscribers of the school by solicitation in any form that is made by technology that is accessed at a place or places other than school office or place of business. We, on our website, for our members would go to our website, they would click, they would enroll online. For the community colleges or others who are using this approved content, we have no control over what they are doing or not doing in terms of on their marketing, but since we are the ones who developed and copyrighted the training program and own the intellectual property itself, we do not want to be brought in under the bill as an agent. And so we did prepare language in an amendment that would clarify the situation very narrowly and specifically to this program.
Thank you. Matt, you want to respond to that? I mean, I think your intention would be to not include that sort of operation as an agent.
Correct, Chair Dembro. If you look at the bill and if you look at the definition of agent, it does not involve the situation that was just described. An agent is an individual who acts as a representative of a school for admissions purposes, to recruit students for admission to enroll in the school. What Mr. Carlson is describing is a situation in which an entity is providing curriculum to a career school. We don't license curriculum providers unless they are providing the curriculum and training themselves. We have instances, particularly in the real estate field, where individuals are receiving training to become real estate brokers, where the school will operate, but they will be purchasing the curriculum from an established provider. and that's usually a provider we're aware of, have had prior relationship with. We review the curriculum. It's usually fine. That sounds like the situation Mr. Carlson's describing, where his organization is providing the curriculum. They're not acting as an admissions agent. So it's a little bit of difference there.
Jim Carlson, for the record again. We just want to make clear for our members who do access the program online and do register online and the like, you know, technically within our own membership for folks we're offering in that program, we will actually, you know, work with our members, and there is information there. So we just want to make sure we're clarifying this and that we're not being brought in under the term. And I apologize. My staff legal counsel originally had been prepared to testify this morning, was under the weather, and so you got stuck with the junior varsity today. But the analysis of our legal counsel was that we probably wanted to clarify the language to make it clear we're not being brought in as an agent. So, and once again, we do not intend to impact what I think the department's trying to get at broadly.
And we have the proposed amendment here, and we'll get it to you, Matt, and you can review it and see if you have objections to that or if you see unintended consequences by that change. And once we feel comfortable, we'll bring it to a vote. Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the issue is not the delivery of the curriculum content that you're concerned about. It's the affording to the potential user of the curriculum content the right to access it and make the decisions about whether they're going to.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, my understanding is it's really when we're getting into, I guess, some of the definitions in here, what constitutes being an agent. And so I think that's where we're, you know, and I think I would not anticipate a problem working with the department to make sure we both are meeting our stated objectives.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very
much. Thank you for your time. Kevin, thank you for your good work.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the work session on...
Public hearings.
I'm sorry, the public hearing on House Bill 2185, 86, 87, 88, 89, 90, and 91. The Vice Chairs and I will be meeting soon, and we'll look at these and... decide which ones can go forward immediately and then which ones we need further information from the stakeholders. So you should be getting these pretty soon, at least some of these pretty soon for a vote. Okay, well, thank you for your patience, audience, for this long and at times technical hearing, but the issues here are very, very important. On Wednesday, we'll be devoting the entire session to a public hearing on House Bill 2187. That's the tuition equity hearing. If you want to be in this room, I suggest you get here early. Okay.
You have the number wrong, but I don't know.
2787. 2787, I'm sorry. I'm still in ODE land. Sorry. So with that, we are adjourned.